The second case for oral argument this morning is Selway Homeowners versus Cummings. Mr. Thomas Brady, an attorney from Spearfish for the appellant, and Mr. Lester Neese, an attorney from Spearfish for the appellee. Mr. Brady, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you and good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. Mr. Neese. Represent Funeil Fierro Cummings, the respondent, the defendant, and appellant in these proceedings that relates to the plat that she and her siblings prepared or had prepared in their behalf, which was filed in Lawrence County in 1986 as the Selway Estate Development. The plat is Respondent's Exhibit B, and that is the exhibit of the greatest and nearly sole significance of this litigation, this dispute, and this appeal. A portion of that plat appears on page 6 of the appellant's initial brief. And it's that document which is the determinative document of the issues of this appeal of the matters in dispute and upon which we request you review for your decision. Starting with the seminal case of Atlas Lumber Company v. Quirk, the Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota in 1912 set forth the concept and the criteria upon review of such a document when it stated that the court is to follow the common sense application of the graphic depictions on the plat. And it is that principle which my discussion this morning shall focus and why we believe the trial court was in error, finding the document to be ambiguous, thereby allowing the trial court to be drawn into what I would call the abyss of all the other information, the testimony, the documents, the exhibits, etc. The trial court should have, and I believe erroneously did not, conclude the plat to have been clear on its face as to the easements and right-of-ways as platted thereon.
Well, how can you say it's not ambiguous when, you know, the key element says, you know, 66-foot right-of-way, future use? I mean, future use means it excludes present use. It means sometime in the future. So how can you say it's not ambiguous?
Okay. There's one right-of-way on this plat, not more than one. There is one, and it is clearly identified on this plat. First of all,
that's the one down the center, dedicated. It's dedicated 66-foot public right-of-way.
No, that is part of the right-of-way. That's down the center. There is a cul-de-sac on the south end and an extension to the east. Okay? And let me explain why I say there is one right-of-way on this plat. As is set forth on the plat document, and the key to it is it shows where there's a black dot, and those are identified as number 5 rebar with aluminum caps. And you look at the plat.
You're talking about placement pins?
Correct.
Okay.
All right. And what note 4 says to the plat, property pins along road are set at the intersection of property line and road right-of-way line. Okay? And you look at the plat and you follow the dots from the north to the south, and on each side of the 66-foot right-of-way, the pins are set through the tangent of the radius of the curve coming off Highway 14A. Then they are set at each property line of lots one, which is to the west, etc. And it goes around. It goes around the cul-de-sac on the south end. It comes back and goes to the east between lots 8 and 9, back to the west, and back to Highway 14A. Those are the dots that are defined by the plat by the rebar.
Well, but you've got rebar pins separating the exterior boundaries and the lots all the way around the exterior of the whole subdivision.
That's correct, too. But you must look at Note 4 on the plat. Note 4 on the plat gives you the description of what these are. Their property pins along road are set at the intersection of property line and road right-of-way line. Okay? Now, the dots are connected by a dashed line. And the entirety of the right-of-way, which I submit is a singular right-of-way, is that contained within the dashed line connecting the dots. So it is both that north and south 66-foot right-of-way, as well as the 70-foot radius cul-de-sac, as well as the east-west portion of the right-of-way.
Okay, let's say I buy 100% of the argument you've just made. But then I look at the language specifically in that east-west, whatever it is, and it says 66-foot right-of-way future use. Doesn't that, at the minimum, create an ambiguity as between that language and the language in Note 4, which then authorizes the trial court to do what it did?
Well, I disagree because for several reasons. First of all, future use is inserted parenthetically. Secondly, it is addressed in, I believe, both the Tenaglia case and in the Bergen case, as that's a word of information, but it is not limiting, expanding, or whatever. The word in there or out of there has no effect on the fact that it is a 66-foot right-of-way. The future is now. The future was the day after.
But didn't the trial court have to determine what those words future use meant to determine the scope of the dedication that's involved here?
I believe not. Not at all, because whether they're there or not there, it's still part of the entirety of the right-of-way. It's not a separated tract of property from the north-south property.
But now this is a little ridiculous, but obviously it couldn't have meant future use for an airport runway. Correct.
It's a dedicated 66-foot right-of-way.
For what future use, though? For what particular future use?
That's the designation on there. Right-of-way connecting to Highway 14A.
And then is it public or private?
It's public.
Why would the developer use the word public on one but not the other? And that means something by that.
Well, I think that is attempting to create an ambiguity when you should be looking at this from a common sense application of the graphics as they're showing, because there is not a separation. That east-west portion of this is contained within and part of the entirety. And so it's not a separate property. Not a separate easement, not a separate right-of-way. And I think as an example on this document that's precisely on point is you look at the 70-foot radius cul-de-sac. That's 140 feet in diameter. And nowhere on that cul-de-sac does it say dedicated, does it say public, or does it say right-of-way?
But it doesn't say...
That's exactly the point. Then why didn't they do the same thing on the disputed right-of-way? Why didn't they leave it blank? If it was left blank, it would be included just like the cul-de-sac. But they didn't leave it blank. They put different language on it.
Well, and I guess that's a distinction, I think, that's not a difference, nor is that controlling in the application and interpretation of this. Because as to that cul-de-sac, if you take that logic forward, when it says dedicated 66-foot public right-of-way in the north-south portion, then is only 66 feet of that cul-de-sac part of it, or does it end? Is that not dedicated? Is that not public? No, I think it's very appropriate that the common sense application is that the entirety of the right-of-way as encompassed by the dotted line connecting the dots is precisely what it's designated as such, a dedicated and public right-of-way. Because there is no separation. There is no line to identify any portion of that different than the next. And so, and if you try to differentiate, you are going to create ambiguities in every plat. Every public document on file is an undotted I an I, is an uncrossed T a T. And that is not common sense to do that. The person needs to look at this document, look at the note, that's part of it, and it says that the property pins along road are set at the intersection of property line and road right-of-way line. And that line encompasses the entirety of that, the cul-de-sac, the east-west and the north-south. And so when you start attempting to make a distinction, I believe you're creating an ambiguity rather than avoiding one when the clear intent of the document appears to show that it is a right-of-way. And dealing with ambiguities, it must be viewed objectively and by a reasonably intelligent person examining the context of that.
Well, is there any significance to the fact that apparently this is nothing more than a hay pasture, they got trees in it, they got a well right up next to it? If there was this crystal clear intention to make it a road, they make the north-south one a road, but this east-west one is apparently a cow pasture. It's never been used for much of anything. Is that even relevant?
Well, it annexes to property to the east, and that property to the east was owned by a member of the developing group. And so, yes, there's a very rational and logical reason why something like that would be there. The primary north-south road was to gain access of those lots that were platted in 5.01-acre tracts. And the road to the east is to access adjoining property, and it goes to that property. And so so it's on there for future development. It's on there to look to the future. That's not an uncommon proposition in platting, nor is that an uncommon proposition that's come before this court, because this court has, in cases before, stated that the term future was of no consequence, as I interpret those cases, in that it was a distinction without a difference. It's informational, but it certainly does not eliminate the significance that it was a dedication and dedicated publicly as the certificate of the owners so state, in that they adopt the language and everything as contained on this plat as their stated intent and purpose for this property. And when the commission, county commission, approved that, that was an acceptance by the county commissioners of that dedication, which made it a public road, and therefore it is not ambiguous. And with the basic principle as set forth in Atlas and as followed in Tenaglia and most recently in Bergen, a person looks at this and within the confines of the dashed line connecting the dots, that is the right of way. And there are not separate parts. For if you would interpret such to be different or separate, then the same conclusion would deal with the cul-de-sac on the south end. And there isn't anyone in this room that would say that that isn't part of the publicly dedicated right-of-way. even though it's more than 66 feet, and even though it's not designated as public or as dedicated.
Well, the line comes right down the north-south middle of that highway, and then it goes through the cul-de-sac, and right to the right of the cul-de-sac, it says cul-de-sac 70 feet R, which I'm assuming means what, right-of-way?
Radius.
Radius, thanks. So doesn't that weaken your argument that, because it is described down there as part of the road, the north-south road?
Weaken my argument? Absolutely not, because a 70-foot radius is 140 feet diameter.
Uh-huh.
And the wording down here says 66 feet right-of-way, public dedicated. And so is the cul-de-sac not a dedicated public cul-de-sac on this plat? Is that, it would have to be. That would have to be an unambiguous conclusion of any court, that that's part of the dedicated.
Of course, the status of the cul-de-sac isn't really before us. So whether it's public or private doesn't affect the outcome of this case, does it?
That issue is not here, but I'm just explaining why the concept of applying the common sense application of the graphic depictions. It's the graphic depictions on this plat that you must look at. And it's clear that the intent is that it's one right-of-way in the entirety of the area contained within the dashed line connecting the dots.
Okay. You have less than 4 minutes left, and you might want to assume at this point that you've satisfactorily answered the question as to whether there's an ambiguity. Now I think you should assume in the event there's an ambiguity, determined to be an ambiguity, maybe you want to address the rest of the issues?
If that were the case, then what the court has held, that this is a private easement, and then can that private easement be vacated in the process as it was done? The answer to that is no, because still, by definition, O'Neill Cummings is a proprietor, and her rights are affected by that. If it's a public dedication, then there's twofold reason why the court could not do that. And so as a matter of law, no matter how they got there, there's error, and the court must be reversed, and that easement must be, the right-of-way must be restored to the status as it was, because the procedure followed was erroneous.
Anything further?
Certainly not.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from you again. Mr. Neese, sir, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you for the opportunity to argue before you. Issues are quite well defined. I'd like to spend a little time, if I may, talking about the cases which were cited both in the appellant's brief and in reply brief. That being Atlas Lumber, a case out of Kansas called Arnold v. Weicker, the Belfouche versus Dittman case. The appellant's take on this is that the graphic depiction on this Selway plat is so similar to the Atlas case, for example, or to the Welker or Arnold v. Weicker case, the one from Kansas where we don't have a copy, a depiction of what it was, but a description in words of what was going on. And if I might, I'd just like to compare and contrast these plats. You know what the Selway plat looks like. It's a plat of 12 lots in a rectangle with a dotted right-of-way running north and south, accessing Highway 14A, dedicated public right-of-way 66 foot north and south. We say the trial court agreed and found that the offshoot to the right between lots 8 and 9 was a private easement. Now this case could be called a street or a road case, but it's a right-of-way case. This is what we're talking about. These aren't dedicated roads or streets. It's a right-of-way. That's what's on the plat. So that's what we're talking about. That's where we start as the distinction between this and Atlas Lumber. If you look at the Atlas Lumber plat, that was an addition
to the city of Highmore in 1885, was when that was platted. It was an addition to a town center. And if you look at the plat, you see blocks and lots inside those blocks with alleys running between them. The blocks are numbered. And then we have open areas of streets, and the streets are named. Except when you get to the middle of the plat, there's a railroad running east and west, I think it is, whatever direction, it's running right through the middle of this open, undesignated area. It doesn't say anything as far as what street name it is.
It has numbers, and the surveyor certificate on the Atlas plat says that the streets, alleys are denoted by width. So these widths are in there. If you look at the plat, you'll see the numbers of the width written there. But it doesn't say that it's Broadway Street or anything. It's just undesignated. And so the question became, in that particular case, there was a dispute between some parties. Well, was this a street or not? Well, the Supreme Court in that case said, here we have a plat with streets designated everywhere except here, where we've got these, nothing's there. It's just a railroad right-of-way, and nothing else is written. And it said, I'm just going to try to get to the heart of it. The court said, well, it's not a lot. It's not a block. It must be a street. And then looking at the logic of it, it was undesignated. Nobody really knew what it was supposed to be. But in reading the case, it says, naturally, the presumption is that one who records a plat and who records it, it records on its spaces, that appear to form no part of any platted lots, that person dedicates the land represented by the spaces thus excluded to public use. Absolutely. That's not the Selway law, by any means. There's no undesignated space here. There are expressed words of reservation, 66-foot ROW, future use, as opposed to the north and south right-of-way, which is clearly publicly dedicated. So we would say that, nice try, but Atlas Lumber doesn't fit the facts of this case. There is no open spaces that are undesignated here. Arnold B. Weicker, now that was a town in, I believe it was Kansas, Peace, Kansas, and if you read the description of what was going on there, they had a platted town site, and there was a depot in the kind of in the middle of town, and it laid between Broadway Street and 10th Street, and 7th, 8th, and 9th Streets were cut off because of the depot. And the depot had a line around it, and it was a 300 square foot area, or 300 whatever area, 300 foot rectangle. But the point was, there was a couple of undesignated strips on the north and south that didn't say anything, didn't say if they were streets, didn't say what they were, but they were undesignated strips. Key point being that 7th, 8th, and 9th Streets all fed into them, and so did Broadway Street. And was that strip not there, it would cut off access to several of the lots. And so the court looked at that and said, well, in looking at the plat, was it intended to be reserved as a lot for sale, or was it dedicated to the public for access? They held that it was dedicated to the public for access. Again, we're not there. That case just doesn't fit the facts of the Selway plat. There are no undesignated spots there where we have to wonder, well, what is this?
But isn't that his point, the point of your opponent, that there's just simply one dedicated public right-of-way here, it's 66 feet wide, except where it comes into the cul-de-sac, and it's all within the dots that connect the that are connected by the dotted lines. He's saying there's just one singular dedicated public right-of-way here. I mean, there is no undesignated space. So what do you have to say to his argument?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that the words overcome the graphic depiction. There's a reason why those words, dedicated 66-foot public right-of-way, read up and down, north and south, and those words do not appear east and west.
And why in the world wouldn't anybody who's going to make it clear that they're dedicating something to the public, by the way, Your Honor, going behind this in the way that the trial court did, there's lots of reasons why the owners of these lots didn't understand this was ever to be a public highway. And so the plat itself, of course, I can't deny it. It's right there in black and white. The dotted lines run a course. There's no division. I agree. There's no division between that north and south right-of-way and the east and west right-of-way. But consider this from the Knight case. You know, the Knight case is our case, we believe, because it talks about easements. That's what we're talking about here, is an easement. And if you read the Knight case, right away, this court lays out the facts of what was going on in Knight. And in Knight, we have a piece of property that attaches to South Canyon Road, or whatever the name of it is, in Rapid City there, with a strip, a 0.78-acre strip, and it's called, on the plat, it's called a road and a lane. It's found to be a private easement. So, is the fact that you have a connection between a public right-of-way, a public access, and a private, through a private use, is that mean now that because we don't have a line between that public right-of-way and that private right-of-way, that we've suddenly dedicated that private right-of-way to the public? I mean, that flies in the face of Knight. If that was the law, if it was required that we had a line between a public and a private right-of-way, even though the words are there, then I would submit, as Mr. Brady did, that we'd have ambiguity all over the place. If my private driveway would access onto a public road, and if that plat happened to not show a demarcation, I've suddenly got a dedicated public right-of-way right into my driveway. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense. We understand the argument of the opponents to this in saying, look at the plat, there's one continuous line. We say, look at the plat and the words that are on the plat. Number one, nowhere on this plat is there a dedication of anything except on that north-south right-of-way. There's no certificate here that dedicates the road, nothing. It's just not there. Number two, the only words of dedication are found on that north and south right-of-way. It accesses a public road. Number three, as the appellant did, if you look at the minutes of the Planning Commission, they talk about the specifics of the road grades and the road plan for the main road, they call it. But then they said, there's also been reserved a 66-foot right-of-way for future use. And any discussion about roads on that hadn't even been submitted yet. Even the Planning Commission was looking at this as something that was going to be discussed in the future. And then when you look at the conduct of the parties, I'd like to add, in 1991 and 1992, when these same individuals came in to start platting the neighboring property, if you read the minutes of the Planning Commission, there's no discussion about, oh, well, there's this 66-foot public dedicated right-of-way right next door. The minutes never talk about it. In fact, in 1992, at the County Commission, there was discussion about should we dedicate the 66-foot public right-of-way on the neighboring land that was owned by the same people.
Of course, to get to all this...
What's that?
To get to all this, you're talking about this historical context or whatever you want to label it. We have to find there's an ambiguity.
Correct.
And that Mr. Brady is saying there's not one.
I agree. Correct.
Okay.
I'm just saying for the record, you know, but I don't know what you're going to decide, so I'm just going to have a complete argument. I'm
sure.
Just saying, while you're at it and you're looking at this situation, just consider that comment in the public records there in 1992, where the Planning Commissioner told the County Commissioners, this needs to be a publicly dedicated 66-foot right-of-way for future development purposes. There's no discussion at all about any right-of-way on neighboring property. Nobody was treating it, in other words, what I'm getting at is nobody was treating it as a road. And it's not a road today. That's in the record. Concerning the, I guess I really don't have any more to say about the ambiguity on the plat. It you'll either decide it's there or it isn't. Our take on it and our presentation to the trial court and the trial court's conclusion was that it was ambiguous. Then when we get to the ambiguity, what is it? What future use and when? Well, that's when we get into the merits. We don't have a record. So I won't address this.
Before you go there any further, I want to talk about a proprietor. What is a proprietor?
Okay.
Now, Section 17 says that you may not abridge the rights of a proprietor. In Section 16, if we use the doctrine of in paria materia, Section 16, which is a related statute, clearly makes a distinction between a developer proprietor and an owner of the lot. Now, why should that distinction not be incorporated into Section 17 of the statute?
Well, I believe that Section 16 is talking about the offering of lots for sale, or the vacation of a plat before lots are offered for sale or after they're offered for sale. That was what we concluded in our brief. On the other statute, the one we're talking about here, 17, am I right? That's the one we're talking about here. Just simply the word proprietor is used, which is the word that's talking about before lots are sold in 16. Before lots, a plat can be vacated before lots are sold by the proprietor. After the lots are sold, we go to the owner. In 17, the word proprietor and owner apparently are merged. We don't have both. We just have proprietor. Our argument to the court on that issue is this. It's one of...
Just a minute, though. If they're merged, if owner and developer are merged in the word proprietor, then the appellants here are a proprietor. I just heard you say they were merged.
Well, let's put it this way. Let me retract what I said. They're not merged. The term proprietor in 17, we would submit, cannot be interpreted to include those individuals that originally platted the property. Because if that was the case, we could have proprietors of a plat who are long dead, who could not sign anything, and that plat could never be vacated.
Would a proprietor be somebody who'd been a developer and, say, sold the lot and took a mortgage back? They're not really an owner anymore, but they certainly have some kind of an equitable interest.
That could be, Your Honor. You know, the term proprietor is determined by the trial court, which is the definition that I'm bound by, is the one who has a legal right or exclusive title to anything. So someone who might have an equitable interest could be determined to be a proprietor. The point in my argument to this court is that the trial court found that Fauniel Fierro Cummings was not a proprietor because she didn't own a lot in the Selway subdivision. Even though she may have been an initial developer, she didn't own a lot there anymore.
Well, we have to think about the future and how this will be used in the future because of the court's decision. When does a proprietor cease to become, excuse me, when does a developer cease to become a proprietor?
A developer ceases to become a proprietor when the developer has no longer a legal interest in the property.
Does that mean when there's no lots left? Does that mean when the mortgages are paid off? What does that mean?
It's going to depend on the governing documents. For example, if the developer has retained a right within the development, then the developer could be a proprietor for in perpetuity, I suppose, if they retain some sort of a right of reversion. I mean, I there could be probably lots of ways that you could retain a right. Maybe you could retain a permanent ownership of one piece of property on the corner forever. I don't know. But once a developer has sold the lots, the developer has retained nothing in there. You know, the point here is, if that was a public dedication, I mean, if that 66-foot ROW future use was a public dedication, then the developer can't sit here and say, hey, I've got legal rights to that. It's a publicly dedicated issue. According to the statute, the title vests in fee to whatever is granted in the public. So that can't be where the rights come from. If they're going to argue that it's public dedicated, they cannot be a proprietor of that plot. because they don't have any rights in there anymore. They've dedicated it to the public. If it's a private easement, which we claim it is, yes, then they could be a proprietor. But in this case, Your Honor, that right that they supposedly retained as a private easement was lost, was extinguished, because they told people this, they told people that. It was going to be used for a reservoir. It was not going to be used for a public road. And the trial court determined that because of the reliance made by the lot owners, that private easement was to be extinguished by estoppel. So if the trial court's decision is correct, Fawneel may have been a proprietor at one time, but she no longer is a proprietor because that easement has been extinguished by estoppel. So I understand the quandary and I understand the issue. And it's possible, Your Honor, that Fawneel could have had a legal retained interest as a part of the developer in the private easement. But that private easement right was lost, according to the trial court. It was extinguished by estoppel. We would request the court to affirm the trial court in all respects. Number one, that the plat was ambiguous. Number two, that the easement was private and that the terms of the easement, which were represented to the landowners who bought property based on the representation, was that what is not going to be a public road, it was not going to be used for access, it was going to be used as a trail road to get to a water reservoir for fire protection purposes. A tank was built on a neighboring lot, and so the use of that road was completely extinguished. If these persons were proprietors, they lost that proprietary interest through estoppel, and that the court properly ordered the vacation of that plat, and finally that the it falls, of course, then that the county commission would have had the legal authority to vacate the plat because it was not a laid out public highway, nor was there a proprietor involved under the facts of this case. It's possible a proprietor could have been involved under different facts. I'm not going to argue that. I don't know all the different myriad of ways that could happen. But in this case, Fawneel Cummings was not a proprietor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brady, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. In responding to some comments by Mr. Neese, again, there's not much to adhere to the basic concept of reviewing a plat in a common sense manner. And it is the graphic depictions on that plat, as I've discussed earlier. He made the comment to the effect that the owners did not make any dedication or declare the roads to be public or the right-of-ways to be public. I differ in that statement. It may not have been in the verbose manner as was done in other plats as they cite in their appellee brief, but the certificate of owner does say, and I quote in part, that the plat was done at our request for the purposes indicated hereon, and that we do hereby approve the within plat of said land. And that was the certificate of the owner. And so then you look at the graphic depictions on there and the words on there, and the word dedicated in public does appear. The case authority cited indicates that that's redundant. Either one is adequate. So it's done twice. So I think it's undisputed. The north-south is clearly public, and it is clearly dedicated, and the acceptance by the county of this makes it as such. And for reasons as earlier discussed, the confines of the entirety of it would have to be the affected properties, because there is not a separating line. The argument of spaces and things of that nature is a distinction of no consequence or of importance. Often frequently within a municipality, the streets themselves are platted as separate properties, whereas in counties, the property owner gets the privilege of paying taxes to the property line burdened by the right-of-way, as is the circumstance of section lines. Those are not separately platted. But it's the same result. You look at the plat, you look at the map, you look at the graphic depictions on there. As to the proprietor issue, the point has been made by Justice Zinter and I think is properly taken. There is a distinction between proprietor and owner, or else there would have been zero reason to use the word owner, or to use the word proprietor. They would have just said owner throughout. And Bonneal is a proprietor in that she was one of the principals who platted. She was one of the owners who signed the certificate of owner. She did retain ownership of the property to the east, which this right-of-way connects to. And therefore, she is a proprietor and of interest.
What rights, if any, does she still have in the development?
Within the development?
Yes. This development, not the one next door, but this development.
The lots have been sold to other owners, and so it would be the owner's certificate of their dedication, a presentment of this plat as it sets. And so to that extent, how they made that grant to the county of the right-of-way would be something that flowed from them to the county, that these owners of lots 1 through 12 purchase their property and of which their property is subject to.
I understand that, but what rights does she retain today in the development at issue?
I would submit as to that specific property, I'm not aware of any, other than the fact that the right-of-way to the east adjoins property that she in fact owns. And so whoever owns that property, even though she was one of the principals, even had she conveyed it or whatever, there are still rights, I think, attached to that and would flow to that because of the public dedication and the right-of-way that appears on there.
Are you completed your presentation?
I certainly can. We would respectfully request this court to review this, find the plat to not be ambiguous, that it's clear on its face, that you apply the 90-year-old principle of common sense application of the graphic depictions on the plat, and not invite litigation at the circuit court level and then this court for every possible manner in which someone can try to create an ambiguity when the document itself is very clear what the intent and purpose was. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.